There was a report that was presented to the legislature actually earlier this year, and we're going to get updated because those needs are still before us, and there's a number of challenges ahead. So we will hopefully have time for discussion, and inevitably there will be proposals we'll be addressing very soon when we're in full session. Before us is the agenda. We have six or so persons that are going to testify, and start from the department, Dr. Melcher. And as always, for presenters, for the record, please state your name and who you're representing. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of School Finance at the Department of Education. And with me this morning, I have Mark Bollinger from the Minneapolis Public Schools and Bob Indahar from Moose Lake Public Schools, who were the co-chairs of our school finance funding for facilities working group. So we're going to walk through a presentation that summarizes the work of the committee. I'll go through first with some of the details, and then these two gentlemen will present some of their perspectives on the work of the committee. So the school finance facilities financing work group was created based on legislation that was passed in 2013. Senator Stump was the chief author of the legislation calling for a study of school facilities funding to create adequate, equitable, and sustainable funding for school facilities throughout the state. The legislation required that the working group include representation from the school superintendents, school business managers, facilities, school facilities directors, and the School Boards Association. And there was a February 1st, 2014 deadline for the work of the committee. We had 16 members on the working group, including three representing each of the organizations that were referred to in the legislation, and four additional members that were appointed by the commissioner, including a representative of the charter school community. The group was intended to provide balanced representation for urban, rural, suburban districts across the state, including school districts and charter schools, including schools that currently receive the alternative facilities funding that's available only to the largest districts, and those that do not receive that funding. The working group had seven half-day meetings between August 2013 and January of 2014. The first thing the working group did was to establish some principles for funding of school facilities, starting with the direction from the legislation was that that any new funding system should be adequate, equitable, and sustainable over time. They also saw as priorities that all districts should have access to comparable funding for comparable needs based on a uniform procedure and criteria throughout the state, that local districts should take the lead in determining school facilities project scope rather than having a top-down directive from the state as to what the facilities should look like, that funding formulas should be as simple as possible so as to minimize the amount of administrative burden and paperwork, that property tax levies for facilities should be equalized in a manner that minimizes variations in revenue per student for comparable tax effort across the state, and that is provides stability over time, that there should be some special provisions to ensure that school districts that have incurred damage due to natural disasters have access to adequate facilities, that funding for charter schools should be comparable and fair in relation to funding for district schools, and that facilities funding should promote sound long-term planning and efficient use of resources. So those are the kind of the general goals of the facilities group. They had a number of recommendations, and the first recommendation dealt with long-term facilities maintenance. It's an area where we have quite a bit of disparity across the state because we currently have two systems in place for funding facilities maintenance. We have what most would consider to be a very good system in place for the largest 25 school districts in the state. And then we have a system in place for all of the other school districts that doesn't provide the same level of support for long-term facilities maintenance. So what the committee recommended was that over a period of time, we work toward establishing a system for long-term facilities maintenance that is consistent across the state and moves us in the direction of what we currently do with the largest 25 districts in the state in terms of having them develop a plan that's based on their needs rather than an arbitrary rate of funding per student. And that the plan would also make sure that there were no districts that lost any funding because of the transition. So under this plan, there would be a phase-in, because we know it's a major change from where we're at currently, and the proposal was to phase in a change over a four-year period starting in 2017 that would increase the current maximum allowance for deferred maintenance for the smaller districts up to $300 per pupil unit in 2017, $400 per pupil unit in 2018, $500 per pupil unit in 2019, which is about the average that the larger districts spend currently. And then in 2020 and later, we would have a system that would be uniform throughout the state, where school districts would be submitting a plan to the department in terms of what they believe their facilities needs are for long-term maintenance. As far as equalization of the long-term maintenance formula, the recommendation from the committee was that school districts have a choice of taking care of their long-term facility maintenance either on a debt service basis or a pay-as-you-go levy basis, which is the way that we currently provide for facilities funding for long-term maintenance in the largest districts in the state. In some cases, it makes more sense to do that on a bonding basis for large projects. In other cases, districts prefer to do a pay-as-you-go so they're not incurring a debt. And so the recommendation was that the smaller districts have access to those same two funding mechanisms, and that we provide equalization based on 125% of the state average property tax base per pupil. So school districts with below average tax base would receive equalization aid to help with part of the cost of that long-term maintenance program. This chart has a lot of numbers on it. I won't go through all of them, but this is the current level of funding for long-term facility maintenance. And if you just look at the numbers in the lower right-hand corner, what that says is that currently for alternative facilities funding, this is basically paying for deferred maintenance, fixing the roof, repairing things that have worn out, not adding anything new, that the 25 largest school districts that are currently in the alternative facility program are spending about $510 per pupil to maintain their facilities on an ongoing basis. The other school districts in the state, on the average, are spending about $212 per pupil for those purposes. Those other districts are required to get approval from the voters for a bond issue in order to take care of their long-term facility maintenance needs, roof repair, and so forth. And so what we're seeing is that we believe that the larger districts are doing a good job of taking care of the needs of their facilities, and it costs about $500 per pupil to do that. And the other districts are probably taking care of something less than half of what's really needed to maintain the investment that we have in our buildings. And as a result of that, we've got growing problems in our smaller districts in terms of being able to maintain facilities that are in good shape and that provide a good environment for learning. This is the kind of graphically presenting the way that the committee recommendations work on facilities funding, and it's basically showing that we're projecting that the cost in the largest 25 districts on the blue line here is going to continue to grow a little bit each year, up from the current $510 per pupil up to $564. And what the committee recommendations would do would be to gradually narrow that gap so that the smaller districts are coming a little closer to what the larger districts are able to do currently in terms of their facility funding needs. This chart shows the average funding statewide is roughly $300. That's what you get when you average $500 for the big districts and $200 for everybody else. So what we're seeing here is we would gradually be ramping up so that all districts would be in that $500 per pupil range, and that would increase the average to about $555 per pupil by 2020. As far as the state share of facilities funding, what we've seen in the last 10 years is a drop from about 13% of the money being paid by the state down to about 7%, so the other 93% is covered by property tax. And the committee recommended that we have a mix that was more three-quarters property tax, one-quarter state aid so that we're able to provide some assistance to the school districts that have relatively low tax base so that they're able to have the same excellent facilities that other districts are able to have. So moving to the second recommendation of the committee, this has to do with debt service equalization. Historically, the state of Minnesota has relied on local property taxes to fund debt service levies. That's when school districts mostly are building new buildings. Back in 1993, the state established debt service equalization. However, we haven't kept that system up to date over the years, and what we've seen is a gradual erosion of that program where most districts don't qualify for any debt service equalization anymore. It only helps a few districts with extremely low tax base. And so what the committee recommended is that we lower the threshold to qualify for debt equalization. Currently, you have to have a tax rate more than 15.7% of adjusted net tax capacity to qualify for any debt service equalization at all. And the committee recommended lowering that to 10%. And they also recommended simplifying the equalization formula, eliminating the current two-tiered system, replacing it with a one-tiered system that is, in plain language, that works better. So let me share with you a few statistics about the current system. So currently, 79% of all of the debt service levies don't qualify for equalization at all. They're all under that 15% threshold. 14% of the current levies qualify for Tier 1 equalization, and 6% qualify for Tier 2 equalization. Under the proposed system, about two-thirds of the debt levies would still be completely unequalized, but we'd be moving up to 36% of the debt levies that would qualify for some equalization. So we're trying to be in a situation where we have more districts that are in the situation where the state will contribute some portion to the debt equalization. And how does the actual equalization formula work once you qualify? Well, currently, if you qualify for Tier 1 debt service equalization, on the average, the state pays 1% of the cost. So it's almost like it doesn't exist. School districts, even if they qualify for Tier 1 equalization, on the average, only get 1% of the funding from the state, and the local taxpayers pay 99%. And so you really have to get into Tier 2 to get any meaningful equalization, which means your tax rate for debt service has to be extremely high, something like 26% of your tax base. Under the proposal, if you qualify for debt service equalization, the state on the average would cover about 40% of the cost over and above that 10% tax rate. And that would vary depending on where you are in the state. And, of course, the lower tax base districts would receive a higher portion than the higher tax base districts in order to equalize the tax rate that's required to build a certain size building. So under this proposal, if it was fully adopted, the current state share of 3% for debt service would grow to about 14%. So we'd still have 86% of the money for debt service costs being paid by local school districts. But the state share would be pretty similar to what the state share was way back in 1993 when the debt service equalization program was first adopted. So what the committee was recommending was that we kind of reverse this trend of lower and lower state share for debt equalization over time and return to a level comparable to where we were when we first created the concept of debt equalization. Now, another third recommendation of the working group had to do with lease levies and school facilities improvement revenue. We currently have authority for school districts to lease space in buildings when they need extra space for instruction. So as an example, when we had adopted full-day kindergarten, some districts needed extra space, and they were allowed to make a property tax levy for adding on kindergarten classrooms because of the need created there. Or sometimes we have growing districts, they don't have quite enough space, so they'll go out and lease space in the community for some of their programs. The committee recommended that the maximum rate for that program be increased from $162 to $180. Actually, the legislature has increased that to $212. So you've actually gone beyond the level that was recommended by the working group. They also recommended that there be some state equalization of this, and currently we're not equalizing this, so it's much more accessible to districts that have a high tax base than districts that have a low tax base. So currently, on the average, school districts are levying $65 per student for building leases, but you can see it's mostly a suburban metropolitan thing. Suburban districts are levying something over $100 per pupil for building leases, and some of the larger outstate districts are also levying a significant amount for building leases. The committee recommended that the uses of the building lease levy be expanded so that school districts could use that money for some other needed things. One of the things that comes to mind is improved school security. A lot of school districts have issues in terms of making sure that their entrances are secured, and you can't use the building lease levy for that right now. So the idea here was to increase the maximum rate for this and then broaden the uses so that school districts could use that money for some other things that are necessary but currently not covered. The next area where there were recommendations was the capital project referendum levy. And the capital project referendum levy is used currently mostly for technology needs. It's a referendum. School districts go to the voters and get approval. And it's currently used mostly by metropolitan area districts that have a strong tax base. There is no equalization currently, so it's very difficult for a district with lower tax base to take advantage of that. And so what the committee recommended was that the capital project referendum levy be equalized at the same rate as the committee recommended for debt service equalization and for deferred maintenance at 125% of the state average tax base per pupil, to try to make that more equally available to all school districts in the state, regardless of their tax base. Then with respect to operating capital revenue, we've had the same formula in place for many years, and what we've seen is quite a bit of erosion of the operating capital program due to inflation. Operating capital is what we use to pay for kind of the everyday routine maintenance of school facilities. And since the dollar amount per pupil has been stable for so many years, it buys less and less every year as the cost of doing business goes up.
Members, we're going to have a quiz on that formula.
So I'm not going through all the numbers here, but this is the long-term trend in terms of operating capital revenue per student adjusted for inflation. So back in 2003, we were spending the equivalent of $325 per pupil. Currently, that's down to $245 in adjusted terms. So the committee offered what they considered to be a modest recommendation of providing some inflation adjustment there to get the number up to $284, which is still lower than it was back in 2003 in inflation-adjusted terms. They also recommended that the state share of operating capital revenue be increased. The state was funding 100% of the operating capital costs back in 2003 after our 2001 legislative session. And then as we had state budget problems, one of the ways the state chose to balance the state budget was to shift more and more of that operating capital revenue onto the levy. So we've dropped from 100% state share down to 35%. We have made some progress. We're now up to 56%. But this group recommended that we increase the state share closer to 80%. So we're kind of moving back in the direction we were in 2003. Then the committee also recommended that we provide some special assistance to districts with unique needs, and in the form of improved debt service equalization. And the recommendation here was that we use a higher level of equalization for districts that had significant unfunded natural disaster costs. And that was enacted by the 2014 legislature, and it has been used by the two districts that were most affected, and Bob Indahar will speak to that in a moment. Also, there was a recommendation that we have some enhanced debt equalization in the situation of a school consolidation where they need a new building, or if a district had an extremely high debt service tax rate, to try to minimize the need for capital loans. The committee also recommended some improvements in the review and comment process, and those were all adopted by the 2014 legislature. With respect to charter schools, The committee recommended that there be some increases in funding for charter schools to help them with unfunded facility costs in order to provide some equity between the school districts and the charter schools. They also recommended that cooperatives have access to some of these funds so that the allowable uses of the lease levy would be expanded for members of intermediate districts consistent with the facilities improvement program recommendations, and that special education co-ops and education districts, secondary vocational co-ops throughout the state would also be able to use those funding sources to maintain their investment in their buildings. Also that member school boards of intermediate districts and co-ops would be allowed to allocate a proportionate share of their cost to the school districts so that the districts could include that in their long-term maintenance revenue. Now, the committee did some initial fiscal modeling. The recommendations were estimated to cost about $206 million in 2017, $250 million in 2018, and $301 million in 2019. Due to the increase in equalization, there would not be an increase in statewide property taxes. So the net increase would be paid by state aid, but we would have some school districts with an increase in property taxes and others with a decrease. The initial modeling only provided a rough estimate. The committee did not go to the level of detail needed to do an actual fiscal note. So the department intends to update those cost estimates once we have the November forecast done and we have updated data going out through 2019. And these numbers are a little too small to read. I think I'm going to kind of pass on those, but they provide details in terms of what the costs were for the individual components. I can answer questions on those, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over that part of it. So in summary, based on the recommendations of this group, the overall funding for facilities, which is currently in the neighborhood of $1,600 per student, if you include the debt service, the long-term maintenance, the capital project referendums, currently about $1,600. And under these recommendations, it would grow to about $1,900 over a four-year period. And the state share of funding for facilities, currently about 18%, would grow to about 33%. Over a four-year period. So that's kind of a very quick capsule summary, Mr. Chair and members, of the recommendations of the working group. I would like to ask the co-chairs of the committee to make a few brief comments, sharing their perspective from a district perspective.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher, and please introduce yourself, and thanks again for your service on the task force.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Wieger. I'm Mark Bollinger, the Executive Director of Facilities Management and Capital Construction at Minneapolis Public Schools, and just am honored to have co-chaired with my colleague, Superintendent Indahar. And as Dr. Melcher did an excellent job of outlining who was on the committee, I would like to say that it was a very, very well cross-representation of the district. We saw everything from large districts to small districts. We had three ex officio members of the legislature there and three staff members of MDE, as well as a lot of visitors in our meetings. We tried to make this open to everyone. I think one of the key points I want to draw out this morning is that we did not see our friends in the legislature or at MDE come in with any set agenda or tried to ask us to do anything in particular, but left it open, and we all acted, including them, as a great team. And the team brought out the eight principles that Dr. Melcher mentioned and eight recommendations at the same time. We tried to develop a strategy around those eight recommendations so they could be enacted and looked at separately, but I will say collectively they do the job that was asked of us in the Omnibus Bill of 213. We are thankful for the last year's passage of the review and comment section, and for partial passage of the debt equalization for unique situations and needs, of which Superintendent Indahar will mention in a minute. Whether the districts were small or large, as we sat there, we were more concerned about the students. I saw a lot of professionalism. And I saw a lot of commitment of the members, but But their passion for the students always came out in the end, and it was more about them than what the districts were going to gain. So I think these are key points to remember as we go forward. I hope that knowing that it didn't come in just for one reason or another, but first we looked at students, then we looked at equity across the whole district so that we were able to offer something to those students on an equitable basis. So as supporters of education had requested and the state had sanctioned, the school districts and supporters of Minnesota request reform and support of adequate changes of current financing for facilities, which provides more opportunities to renew and enhance school facilities in the state. This in turn provides opportunities, enhancements for the students and communities back in Minnesota. By supporting these recommendations, Minnesota school districts suffer no financial loss, while the students experience the real benefits. We would ask for your support, and in turn, we want to support you as you move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Bob Endahar. I'm the superintendent of schools at Moose Lake, and by the way, a very happy superintendent of schools at Moose Lake, thanks to you guys. And I've talked to many of you before. We were the school that went through the flood, and you passed legislation last session that allowed us the opportunity to pass a bond, and it did pass. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It never would have passed without it. And Chuck Ayler at Rushford Peterson wanted me to thank you as well because their bond passed as well. And so we have other schools throughout the state with not the same issues that we've got, but similar issues. And that is they have old buildings. They're trying to keep them up. They don't know exactly what to do. I would like to echo what Mark said on the committee. We worked hard and long on solutions. We think we have some good guidelines or strong guidelines for you to follow. I'm very proud of the work that we did. I can tell you that I meet with the superintendents in northeastern Minnesota on a monthly basis. This topic is very important to us. We talk about this monthly. We talk about how can we get support for this. How can we make these recommendations get to the point where they are followed through with? I have a feeling you're going to hear about this. You'll be getting your emails, et cetera, from superintendents because we feel that this isn't a small thing. This is a big thing. And you can make a difference for many of the districts in the state with this. I feel that you have a tough job of trying to fix a complex financial system with schools of various varying needs. And I just hope that the recommendations that we came up with will be helpful to you and be a good guide for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. And following the other presenters, then we'll open up for questions. Thanks. We did distribute the 25 districts that are included in the Alternative Facilities Funding Program. And, of course, if you're number 26, 27, or whatever, we get it. We understand why I've authored bills that have included some of these, that include Stillwater and others, and we certainly are aware of the need to address the rest of the state. And as we discussed this more, it's in this the spirit of give to the max day. It's how much are we going to allocate in terms of our funding. But there's no doubt we have a major challenge before of us. Okay. Next, Superintendent Hopla and Bradley. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Wieger, for this opportunity to present to you this morning. I am Peter Hopla, the superintendent of the Carlton Intermediate School District in Carlton, Minnesota. Just as a point of reference, I was at North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale. Thanks to Nancy, she hired me there a few years back. But, Carlton is about 120 miles north on I-35, and if you take a right at the Black Bear Casino in a couple miles, you'll be in downtown Carlton, the gateway to Jay Cook State Park. Okay. Carlton serves about 520 students in pre-K through 12 programs. 111, or 21% of those students, are non-white, all except five of those being Native American. 36% of our students qualify for free or reduced lunch. We serve those students in two buildings. Our new elementary school serves pre-K through 5. That was built in 1962. And our high school, serving grades 6 through 12, the high school was originally built in 1915 with additions in 1917, 1954, and 1969. In reviewing MDE's facilities age and square footage report, I found we did not make the top 10 of facilities by oldest average age. We were number 11, with average age by MDE calculations of 48.62 years. We had CTS Group do a engineering analysis of our district facilities this fall, and they returned to us with a report showing an estimated need for $3.125 million and $4.05 million of updates that are needed to our buildings. These are things like boilers, windows, doors, security systems, and we're not talking about anything that will enhance really the education of our kids in terms of programming. If the Carleton School District spends the average 59 cents per square foot of deferred maintenance money that is available to us for facilities, it would take us 42 to 55 years to complete those projects. With the ability to spend the average $2.79 per square foot that the alternate facilities districts, those 25 largest districts, spend, it would take 9 to 11 years to update. And just based on that, I want to ask, where is the equity? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ron Bradley, currently superintendent at Cromwell, right? I say currently because I failed retirement 4 times, and I'm not sure how long this one's going to last either. Cromwell's 140 miles north on 35, 20 miles west of the Black Bear Casino, and that's not an advertisement for the casino, but that's where we're located. I have 48 years of experience in education. I know I don't look that old, but keep in mind I started when I was 13. I have administrative experience in school districts from my first superintendency was 230 students, and my first retirement was from Elk River, which had 14,000 students. So what I'd like to do today is just compare briefly the challenge that Cromwell has versus what Elk River has. Cromwell, we have a 100,000 square foot building. We have 10-year warrantied roofs that are now 22 years old. We have patches on patches. We have an estimate that it would cost $1.3 million to repair all of our roofs, and they're not in good shape. Our capital outlay levy is $76,000. Our deferred maintenance is $17,000 for a total of $93,000 per year. If we took all the capital outlay and the deferred maintenance money and put it into our roofs, it would take us 15 years to replace all our roofs. And that would be with 30-year roofs. 10-year roofs are just, I don't feel, are adequate. So that means there would be no capital outlay for textbooks, technology, chairs, desks, and those type of items, because we'd be using all our money for the roofs. If we look at Elk River, which is an old facilities district, when I was director of business operations and construction there for 13 years. And according to the MDE 14 payable 15 levy certification, they have 13,958 students in that report. And their ability to levy for maintenance alternate facilities is $6.9 million. If we divide that out, we come up with $495 per adjusted pupil unit. That's what they have ability to levy to maintain their buildings. If we take that figure, $495, and that fits into what Dr. Melchert was referring to earlier, That would generate $173,000, roughly. The number of $1.3 million for roof replacements, now we could, with that ability, we could replace all of our roofs in 7 years, basically half the time. And then we would also have money for textbooks, technology, and other items that we need. The Minnesota Auditor's Office suggests that school districts, and I think it's an industry standard, should spend between 2 and 4% of the value, the building value, on maintenance each year. So if I take that 100,000 square foot building, and if I use a figure of $200 per square foot for construction purposes, that would yield $400,000 a year. Going back to the $495, which would per student, which would generate $173,000, that would give us about a little bit less than 1% for our facilities. So we're not looking at Taj Mahal. We're looking at realistic figures just to maintain our buildings. And I suggest to you that it's our responsibility to maintain our building so that we can provide a safe and comfortable educational place for students to learn, a good environment. So, in the words of a famous person, and that's the rest of the story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, each of you, and again, we'll field questions a little bit later. Next, Superintendent Connie Hayes, District 916. Welcome.
Good morning, Senator Wieger, members of the committee. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. And on behalf of my colleagues at Intermediate 917 and Intermediate 287, we are here today to ask for your support for recommendation number 4, which provides that there is an expansion for the use of the lease levy. The intermediate districts are very fortunate through support from the legislature to have access to lease levy through our member districts. But as the needs of our students change and our facilities age, we find a need to remodel our spaces, put on additions, address long-term maintenance, and improve safety and security. So as I said, those items are consistent with recommendation number 4 in the report. Your materials provide a story about our oldest building at 916 called Capital View Center. Some of you have probably visited there over the years. We purchased it from the Roseville School District a number of years ago when they felt it was too old to keep, and we acquired it. This expanded authority, if approved by the legislature this year, would allow our 916 board to consider a major overhaul of the building as opposed to replacing it. I highlight the story in the Spring Lake Park School District, who did a similar kind of major overhaul of their high school facility a number of years ago. And if you have a chance to visit there, you walk in and it feels like a brand new building. It's just a wonderful way to spend resources. Without the opportunity to consider a major overhaul of the building, the 916 board would have to replace this building at a significant additional cost of about $14 million. The second item that I'd like to draw your attention to is recommendation number 5, recommendation number 1. In that recommendation, the report would suggest rolling the health and safety revenue into a new long-term facilities revenue for typical K-12 districts. If that were to happen, it's possible the intermediate districts would lose access to a very vital additional resource for us, and that is the health and safety. In particular, for our Capital View building, if the board is going to do a major overhaul of that building, the resources needed will really be a combination of this expanded use of the lease levy authority plus health and safety. I really do want to commend the working group for the work that they did and the recommendations that they've provided. Although today I work in the metro area, over the extents of my career, I've spent time in northwest Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, northeast Minnesota, and southeast Minnesota, and now, of course, in the metro area. And the needs are great all over the state. And I know it's not my job to advocate for those other schools, but as an educator, I really do believe this is the time for the legislature to act and provide appropriate resources for schools across the state. And in particular, I'd like to note that other smaller collaboratives around the state who serve a similar kind of population that we do at the intermediates also need support with lease levy revenue. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Superintendent. Next, Matt Hammer from the Association of School Business Officials. Welcome.
Good morning, Senator Wieger and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Hammer. I'm from Director of Finance from Fridley Public Schools, a small district up in the inner ring suburb, northern suburb. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to testify in support of the school facilities work group recommendations and discuss some of the challenges that deferred maintenance is presenting school districts around the state. Many people often like to use the phrase pay me now or pay me later. Well, when you apply that term to deferred maintenance, it's pay me now or pay me more later. And this is a dilemma that many school districts, including Fridley, are facing with maintaining old and aging facilities as we try to ensure our facilities continue to meet the changing needs of our students and communities. I think all the work group recommendations are important and needed, but today I'm going to focus on the recommendations for establishing long-term maintenance funding for all, as well as how the equalization formula plays an important role in all the recommendations that the work group has brought forth. At Fridley Public Schools, our buildings are averaging 50 years of age. Most of them were built in the 60s. As we all know, as things get older, they're a lot more costly to maintain. And as we forecast our facility needs over the next 10 years, we have roughly one-third of our district's roofs that are going to need to be replaced, along with other deferred maintenance projects, including windows, tuck pointing, lentils, so on and so forth, as well as looking at how we're going to make modifications for safety and security. On top of those challenges, Fridley School District is a low property wealth district because we lack that commercial and industrial property that high property wealth school districts have. The effect of this is lacking these properties, our local taxpayers will often pay 2 to 3 times more for the same taxpayer in a high property wealth school district. And for that reason, for that same levy dollar, it is challenging for our school to pass building bonds and referendums because our taxpayers have to pay more for that same level of tax revenue. As you look at the school facility work group recommendations, you'll see equalization is discussed throughout their report. This is directly focused at closing that equity gap that exists in tax bases around the state. The use of equalization will make that cost of a school levy dollar more uniform, ensuring that local businesses and homeowners in poor property districts do not pay significantly more property taxes to generate the same levy revenue for their local schools. So with whatever happens here, this is an important aspect of the work group recommendations that shouldn't be overlooked. The other item I'd like to discuss this morning is working towards equitable access. The goal of the work group was to work towards equitable access for long-term maintenance funding for all schools. And as you know, the current facility funding system isn't equitable. As the work group points out, the largest 25 school districts that qualify for all facility funding today have access to unlimited deferred maintenance funding through their approved all facility plans. And at the time of the work group's report, the eligible school districts on average utilizing approximately $300 more per student of revenue annually than districts that weren't eligible. So basically the net result of that is districts such as Fridley are squeezing and utilize resources from other sources to pay for the same deferred maintenance needs that those districts are paying for. And worse yet, we're often required to defer those projects, leading to greater costs down the road. So with that, I urge you guys to take a look at the work group's recommendation to establish long-term facility maintenance funding, as it provides a phased-in approach that works us towards closing that equity gap for districts today that aren't eligible for all facility funding like the biggest 25 are. And we do have the same deferred maintenance needs as those districts do. After looking at the initial runs of the work group, I do have one point of interest at Fridley, and I think other districts will, that have large health and safety projects that have been approved through health and safety but funded through the health facility program. When I looked at the initial runs, those large health and safety projects that were historically funded through that health facility plan are being included in that phased-in limit approach. We want to make sure that any health and safety project that was approved through the health and safety system, that was funded through the health facility, gets excluded from that calculation and the limits through 2020 for long-term maintenance funding. So that's a point we want to make sure that it just kind of makes sense. MDE approved those health and safety projects for reasons to ensure that our students have healthy environments to learn in, and then we just don't think those should be included in the calculation. So in summary, we know deferred maintenance is going to be a key challenge for districts as we move forward. Our buildings are getting older and more expensive to maintain. We continue to work with limited resources, so we continue to pay more later. So I urge you to consider the recommendations brought forth through the work group in their entirety, and would like you to pay special attention to those recommendations that target equitable access for all school districts, including the recommendations for equalization, and establish a long-term maintenance funding stream that is accessed by all. I thank you for your guys' consideration today.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Next, Heather Nussen from Minnesota Education Facility Management Professionals. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heather Nussen, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Educational Facility Management Professionals, otherwise known as MASMAS. I'm in my 11th year at the Rosemount Apple Valley Eagan School District, where I'm currently the Alternative Facilities Project Manager. I, along with two other MASMAS members, served on the School Facilities Financing Working Group. As an organization representing 180 school districts in Minnesota, the MASMAS membership is mostly made up of facility management professionals. No matter what size our school district is, whether we're located in rural Minnesota or the heart of the Twin Cities Metro, all of our jobs are the same. As facility managers, we take pride in optimizing the learning and working environments of our facility buildings. On a daily basis, we maintain the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. We write specifications, and we go out to bid for projects such as roofing and flooring and asphalt. And on any given day, you can find us up on a ladder with our head above the ceiling tile looking for that notorious roof leak. MASMAS members are extremely appreciative that the 2014 legislature adopted the working group recommended changes to the review and comment policy. By increasing the minimum qualifying amount needed to trigger a review and comment, and by removing the need altogether for most maintenance projects, the process is certainly now more efficient, and for that we thank you. To answer the question on today's agenda, where do we go from here, I would like to turn your attention to recommendation number one. There is undoubtedly an enormous disparity in the current maintenance funding of school districts in Minnesota. The quality of our school facilities does have a direct impact on our students' ability to concentrate in the classroom. As Mr. Melcher pointed out, only 25 districts are currently eligible to receive alternative facilities funding. The other 307 school districts receive minimal funding through deferred maintenance funds. In order to provide adequate, equitable, and sustainable maintenance funding for all of our school districts, we ask that you replace the current maintenance funding and establish a new long-term facilities maintenance revenue program. We all know this is going to take new allocated K-12 funding to start down this path. Since this is the first funding cycle since the committee made our recommendations, we must start this year if we want to give Minnesota students equitable facilities to learn in. We urge the 2015 legislature and the governor to include new funding in the 2015-2017 biennial budget to implement recommendation number one. Adequate school facilities do not claim any particular political party. Every one of us should go forward together on these recommendations. MASMIS knows that school facilities desperately need your help. We are the facility managers that are out there every day in the field. Our kids deserve the very best facilities to learn in, schools that are equal in quality throughout the state. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Next, Jean Piccolo, Association of Charter Schools. Welcome. And then I'll ask if there's anyone else not on the agenda, if they'd like to give a brief statement, then we're going to open it up for comments. Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, and Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, thank you for the opportunity to share a little information about charter school facilities and share with you a proposal about charter school facilities going forward in the future. One of the things, charter schools by statute may not own a building if they use public funds to purchase or construct that building. So all charter schools lease space. I've provided you a short sheet there with some information. There are basically four principles of how charter schools do facilities. One, they must lease space. They cannot own buildings directly if they use public funds. They may have an affiliated building company, nonprofit affiliated building company, if they meet certain criteria. And they are eligible for lease aid to assist in paying lease costs. The reason for the prohibition on owning buildings goes back to 1991 when the law was adopted. The idea of charter schools was a new concept. Minnesota was the first state. Today we have 157 charter schools operating in the state, enrolling over 45,000 students. So about 5% of all public school students now are in charter schools. Over the years, facility became one of the major stumbling blocks for schools. And so in response to that, the legislature enacted lease aid to assist schools in the cost of leasing space, since charter schools cannot levy for facilities. However, the issue of finding appropriate space was not addressed in terms of ownership of the building. And so charter schools created a affiliated building companies back in the late 1990s, a couple of schools, to find space. And this is a common practice in other sectors of the economy where a company or an organization creates another nonprofit to own the building and so forth. The number of schools with affiliated building companies expanded, and in 2003, the legislative auditor made a recommendation to the legislature that the legislature addressed this issue because it was seen as quasi-legal or quasi-irregular. And in 2008, again, the legislative auditor submitted a second report urging that be addressed. In 2009, the association came forward with a major revision of the charter school law, including provisions about these affiliated building companies. And so basically, we set up some criteria or qualifications for building companies. In essence, we regularized the practice and procedures for doing that so they were not going off in all kinds of directions. In 2010, this body held a series of hearings, I think over half a dozen hearings, to come up with a bill or legislation to allow charter schools to own building directly, create a charter school facilities authority, kind of like the higher education authority for issuing bonds, and also would eliminate it eventually the affiliated building companies. Because in the end, when buildings are owned by affiliated building companies, the state has no asset because basically you continue to lease all the time. So there was a massive number of committee meetings and stakeholder meetings, and it passed overwhelmingly in this body, in the Senate. It went to conference committee, and it died on the final weekend because the House wanted some tax policy, and the Senate wanted this, and neither could agree, and so it was dropped. And so for the last 4 years, this issue has continued to hang out there. What we do know, for example, now is that charter schools leased last year leased over 5.2 million square feet of space, an average of 35,000 square foot per, feet per school at a cost of $12.40, an average cost. We now have, we know of at least 33 schools that have affiliated building companies, roughly 20%, and most of them are doing local conduit bonds in terms of funding. You can see on the back side of the one sheet that in the last 2 years, for example, there have been 12 issuances of local conduit bonds amounting to $133 million. And you can see the range and you can see who has issued those. In the previous 14 years, $247 million was issued by local through local conduit bonds. Also, there's other funding sources for charter school facility projects, local banks, the Minnesota Nonprofit Assistance Fund, Capital Impact Partners, which is a national group, Charter School Development Corporation, which is another national group that finances facilities. And in recent, in the last 2 years, we now have charter school management companies who are coming in and building facilities for charter schools, and then they lease those facilities to the charter schools, but they also have a management contract to run those schools. So there is a potential conflict there to some degree. Looking forward, we would like to propose in the coming session legislation that picks up on the legislation from 2010. And basically it has five components: to allow for direct ownership of facilities by qualified charter schools, meaning they've been in existence for a certain length of time, they have financial stability, and so forth. Phase out affiliated building companies and transfer ownership of those buildings to the school, so that if a charter school ever closes, that building becomes an asset for the state after the bonds are paid off. Third, to reconstitute lease aid into a facilities aid program with two components: one for continuing for leases for schools that lease, but then for schools that own buildings and their bonds are paid off, to have a reduced program of aid for asset preservation. So to pay for new roofs and windows and so forth. To establish a charter school facilities authority to issue state revenue bonds, and then an enhancement credit enhancement account that would be paid through annual loan payments of the bonds. We'd also like to see that the facilities or lease aid definition be expanded, because charter schools are required by law to meet all health and safety requirements, but they don't get the levy for that, and so we'd like to see that be expanded into the definition of what lease aid can be used for. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address the committee at this time? Yes, please come forward and identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chair Weger and members. My name is Paul Bourgeois. I'm the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for Minnetonka Public Schools, and I was a MASBO representative on the Education Finance Working Group. I'd like to just make two quick points about the recommendations, in particular for long-term maintenance. As a member, or as one of the districts that has alternate facilities / long-term maintenance, I can attest to you that it does work. The program does work. Our facilities were all built in the 50s. The newest one is 1967, so 47 years old. But over the last 7 to 8 years, we've been able to bring them up from deferred maintenance, once we qualified for the program, into a state of good repair. And so we're leveraging the investment that the community has already made, and those buildings will still be viable 50 and 60 years from now. So the program does work. And school boards and business managers and maintenance managers make good decisions in utilizing the money. Then the second point I'd like to make is that in terms of utilizing these dollars, you kind of get a two-for-one benefit from the standpoint of Not only then are you preserving infrastructure and providing a good learning space for students and helping education, but the jobs of these projects are good-paying construction-type jobs that will benefit a lot of hardworking people. Over the course of every construction season, every summer, while these things are going on, so you kind of get a double benefit in terms of helping people, hardworking people with good-paying jobs, and also then preserving and protecting and extending the life of the infrastructure. So, thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? Okay. Well, members, I would like to ask Senator Stumpf if he would like to offer a perspective as the past chair of this committee, chair of capital investment, liaison to the task force, the working group that has put together these recommendations, a rural legislator. What are your thoughts at this point as we enter session?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of thoughts. And the first thought is that just as being the past chair and seeing kind of a historical perspective as what's happened, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Dr. Melcher in the effort that he's championed over quite a length of time, a great advocate for equalization. And I think having worked in the finance part of it, I think you really get to see the disparities between different programs. I have another question I was going to ask Dr. Melcher in a minute, but then the other person is our chair, Senator Wieger. I happen to be one of the members of the conference committee in the budget that was passed back in 2013. And I was very pleasantly, a great opportunity to watch our chair, our current chair, in being open to ideas from all sectors of the state, which I thought was something that was an opportunity for us to move some of these things that were obstacles over the years, such as equalization, and then also we work very closely during that conference committee with the chair of the tax committee, Senator Skoy. And it's hard, I think it's very hard to have one universal formula that kind of satisfies all of the different situations across the state, because we have independent schools all over the place, and they vary in size from, I think the smallest one's probably about 15 students up in the northwest angle to, I think is Anoka, I think the largest right now, which is, probably, 40,000-50,000 students. So I really appreciate that. The two questions I have, one is that committee met before we had passed all-day kindergarten as a program in the state. And I was just wondering, has that changed the outlook on any of those recommendations or put more of an urgency in that? And then the second kind of thought was, when you look at the fiscal impact, and I know we'll have a more accurate one after the forecast, when you look at that fiscal impact in 2017 of like $206 million, and you look at, and maybe the chair or somebody could help me out here, but I think the total appropriation for education in that 2013 funding bill, I think, was somewhere around $13 billion. Is that?
Yeah. Dr. Melcher,
yes, for the biennium, yes. So when you look at the 17 appropriation of $206 million and 18, you'd have to combine those two, right? Because I just want to get a perspective of what kind of an increase we might be asking for. And I think it's relatively small, considering the impact it would have across the state.
Yeah, well, as Dr. Melcher come up, and maybe if you look at page 5, slide 29, I believe it is, where it talks about the fiscal impact and some of the initial modeling. And if we're looking at the next biennium, which we will, for scaling or fully implementing, what would that be? And Dr. Melcher, earlier you said you're going to be looking further into these numbers to update and factor items. So if you could respond to Senator Stump's inquiry.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I was just looking for the right slide here. I would say that the working group.
It's slide 29.
Slide 29. Okay.
Page 5.
I've somehow lost my.
Okay.
And I can't help you out because those numbers are so small I can hardly read them.
We know they're big numbers.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Okay, so we had very preliminary estimates from the working group. $206 million in fiscal 17, $250 million in fiscal 18, $301 million in fiscal 19. That was based on all of the recommendations of the working group. And those included amounts for the deferred maintenance part, which we heard a lot of testimony about today. It also includes the debt equalization piece and so forth. So I guess one thing I would say is that all of these recommendations are scalable and they move in the direction that you heard a lot of testimony on. So it's not like a $206 million or nothing kind of a decision. But to fully implement the recommendations based on some very preliminary early data, it would be $206 million in the upcoming biennium that we're going to fund. Most of the programs we're talking about here are levies, equalized levies. We've already made the levy for fiscal year 2016 as part of the Pay 15. So if the legislature were to move forward with some or all of the recommendations from the committee, the first year that you would be funding would be fiscal year 17, which would be the Pay 16 property tax levy. So the cost in the biennium, if you were to do all of the recommendations based on this early rough number, would be $206 million.
Senator Stump.
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of a percent increase would that be over the total existing budget?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, if we're looking at, let's say, roughly $15 billion for the biennium, I haven't got my math here. I'm sorry, I'm not very good without having something I can. So we're looking at 200 divided by 1.3%, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chairman.
1.3%, I believe you.
Yes. So,
okay.
Mr. Chair and members, I think for what we have heard and about the need for facilities and in many different areas of our education system, 1.3% increase is a very modest increase across the state. And I think that would really mean a lot to our schools out there. And I hope that we can, work toward that goal.
Thank you. And I think that might be a safe assumption that we all hope we're going to work for that goal. And it's
matter of revenue and determination on priorities. So,
additional questions or comments to Dr. Melcher at this point? Senator Stump and Senator Claussen.
Mr. Chairman, just Dr. Melcher, does the ALDE K program have any impact on the facilities?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, at the time that the committee made its recommendations, we were aware of the ALDE kindergarten changes. And the recommendations of the committee were made in February of 2014 after we had enacted the ALDE kindergarten piece. So we know that we knew that that was coming, and we knew that school districts do have the ability to add on to existing facilities to add classrooms as needed for all-day kindergarten with the school building lease levy. And one of the recommendations of the committee was to equalize that levy so that it would be more equally available to districts that had a low tax base as opposed to districts that had a high tax base. We have, in fact, seen quite a few school districts that have had to add on to existing buildings to address the need for all-day kindergarten. But we also have had some districts that have had to do maintenance. They might have room in the building, but it's not appropriate for kindergartners. And, of course, we have some districts that have the ability to do that with the deferred maintenance program currently, and we have most of the districts in the state that don't have that. So the recommendations of the committee in terms of deferred maintenance and fixing up buildings, I think, would be beneficial.
Thank you.
Ms. Hermanson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, we did do a quick survey of buildings during the working group's discussions, and we didn't hear back from all districts, but it was very evident that they were planning for it. In some instances, we could see where they were pulling together two or three different programs in order to make it work. Some districts had already been offering all-day kindergarten on a fee basis, and so they were. We did seek input from the districts as we were having our discussions, but it was evident that they could use some help with facilities as well.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Melcher, for your work and the committee's work on this very timely and important issue. In your presentation, and also Mr. Hammer, you mentioned the health and safety levy and looking at perhaps expanding, if I remember correctly, expanding into some of the current guidelines that we use for health and safety, especially in looking at safety issues within schools, monitoring students or cameras, television, what have you. It's been my experience that health and safety dollars, to a large extent, are using for programming issues in schools. And as you continue your work, I hope you kind of separate out those two, if it's necessary to move some of those dollars into health and safety. But I think sometimes crossing over the purposes of those two programs might get a little confusing, and I just would encourage that we take a good look at that and that we don't cross over the purposes of those two programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's noted for the record. Okay. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melcher, I don't know if during the process of deliberation, a list of the particular districts that are most in need was developed, and how that kind of matches the kind of their tax capacity. And the reason I would like to see this table is because as I hear the testimony of the people who the superintendents who came today, the request is for very basic things. No one is asking for, an expansion of a gym or media center. They are talking about roofs and just very basic needs. And I am concerned that we're not even meeting those needs. And so when we talk about, the 21st century and the need for media and just adapting these buildings and everything, it's just incredible that we are so behind. So I'm curious as to what is our current and our future capacity, tax capacity within those regions and those areas, because I think demographics as well as, you know, economies impact that future. And so I'm afraid that if we don't take a look at what is happening today in these districts and why they don't have this tax capacity, what is the projection for the future in terms of demographics for those districts? And so how do we develop a formula that is sustainable over time? Do they have to come here every 2 years to beg for a change because we did not contemplate the fact that, you know, this is a situation that for them in the next, you know, few years, that's going to continue? So in terms of, you know, how do you really design a formula that is sustainable over time, I think we need your help in kind of doing a little bit of more analysis over the long term, not just now. I don't know if that conversation took place or if you have thought about that and if you have some ideas as to how we can incorporate that conversation into our next session.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, I would say first that one of the areas that we're lacking in at the state is a good inventory of what the unmet needs are. We know we have large unmet needs in the school facility area throughout the state. I think that the testimony you heard from several people here was very representative of the situation that most of our districts that are not included in the current alternative facility program find themselves. So I would say a majority of school districts are in that situation where they have significant unmet needs and the current revenue streams do not get them into a position where they can maintain adequate facilities unless they're able to convince the voters that they need to pass a bond issue to fix the roof. And what we see across the state is that we have a relatively smaller percentage of the school districts, quite often those that have a pretty strong tax base, that are able to go to the voters and say, gee, you know, the roof needs work, we need to do some improvements for school security, and they're able to get a bond issue passed by the voters. But what that leaves us with is a great deal of disparity across the state because some school districts are in a much better position to ask the voters for help, especially if they have a very strong tax base. So I think what you would see across the state typically is that school districts other than the largest 25, which currently we think we have a very good system, and you heard the testimony from Mr. Bourgeois about that, we think we have a very good system where it's locally determined. I don't think we want to be in a position as a state to say the state's going to determine what you need for facilities and we're going to give you some money to take care of it. We think that we're going to have the best facilities if the locally elected school boards are able to do an analysis of what they need and to develop a long-term facilities plan with some review at the state level, but with the initiative coming locally with the local school districts responsible for the majority of the cost locally, and that maintains that accountability piece along with the review and comment by the state. But without requiring school districts to necessarily go to the voters to maintain the investment that they already have in their building. So the voters have already voted to build a high school. Now the high school is 40 years old and it needs a new roof. Do they need to go back to the voters again to say, should we get the roof fixed or should we wait until we save up enough money to pay for it? And by then we've got other damage that's going to make the bill a lot bigger. And so I think what we're talking about here is to try to make this a more uniform system, to try to make the facilities funding options available to the other school districts more comparable to what I think is a very well-functioning system for the largest 25 we have right now.
Follow-up, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melcher, I think that the inventory is kind of an essential piece in here because I think that without really having an assessment of our situation and really having a comprehensive view of what is going on, it's difficult for us. The formula will help immensely, I think. I think you're correct. But I do think that we are not making major investments that really are that are essential to these districts, and you know, whether it's their tax capacity or priority or whatever it is, I think the inventory will reveal certain elements that help us kind of get a sense of, you know, mapping out what is the need, and then begin to really work with the local entity to have a sustainable plan for the future. Because this is, as I said, it's not just the roof. We may be able to take care of the basic, but over time, I think we need to go beyond just, you know, repairing a roof at the minimum cost. I think these schools need to thrive, and we need to, you know, be part of the 21st century global education system. And so if we cannot even talk about that because we just have to take care of critical needs, it's, I think it's a disservice to our kids and the schools in those regions. So I would encourage the department to tell us, you know, what it would take to build that assessment and that inventory, mm-hmm. so that we have current relevant information every time we meet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sarah Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Meltzer, I appreciate the work you've done on this. You know, as I just took a quick look at our education clause in the Constitution providing a uniform system of public schools, and what you've been able to show and your working group's been able to show is that we have a disparate system of financing, at least the maintenance of those schools, which, you know, as in my experience, where a child goes to school is an important part of their effectiveness to be learning. They need to be in a safe, welcoming, days like today, warm environment. So I appreciate the work that you've done on that and trying to equalize, and that's what I hear from my districts in the outer ring suburbs, is that the equalization formula hasn't kept up. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I had, though, was along the lines of your fiscal impact here, and then I'll, Mr. Chair, if you, I could have a couple of follow-up questions. You know, once we get to the initial fiscal year 17, we see approximately 20% increases in on an annual basis. And what do you see? What are the assumptions that are causing that type of growth?
Mr. Melcher. Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt, that growth is caused by the committee recommendation to phase in this transition from where we're currently at to a system where all school districts had access to the level of funding that the larger 25 did. So what the currently we have a system that allows up to $64 per student for deferred maintenance for the smaller districts, and there's kind of an unlimited amount for the larger districts based on the district's plan. And so basically you have this big gap. When you include the health and safety money in that along with the deferred maintenance money, the larger districts are spending about $500 per pupil, and the smaller districts are spending about $200 per pupil. Mm-hmm. So the committee recommendation was, rather than to say we're going to open this up, and you know, before we have a good assessment, we need an inventory. We need to have local school boards determine priorities and say, well, we need to do this first, then we need to do this. So the idea was, in order to have some control of this and allow for a long planning term, the recommendation was to move to a formula that would have a limit of $300 per student in 2017, $400 per student in 2018, $500 per student in 2019, which would make the smaller districts on the same par with the others. So that's why so basically what you're talking about is ramping up over 3 years and then it would level off.
Thank you. I forgot about the phase-in approach on that.
Mr. Chair Pratt, yes, follow up.
Thank you. And so you talked about three quarters of the burden being on the local community, a quarter of on the state. Your data seems to indicate historically the level back in 2003 was at roughly 14-15%. How did you arrive at that mix?
Dr. Melcher. Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt, the committee recommended that the equalization be set at 125% of the state average tax base per student. So I think the idea was that a majority of the districts in the state would receive some equalization. So if you were about average in terms of your tax base per student, you'd be funding most of the costs locally, but the state would be helping you out a little bit. If you were above 125% of the state average tax base per student, then you'd be funding it locally. So I think we were kind of going off of that notion that that we would have a more sustainable system if we had a system that was sufficient to provide funding for a majority of districts in the state, but not necessarily the districts that had the highest tax base per student, and then trying to keep that indexed over time so that we would always be equalizing at that 125% level. One of the lessons we learned from the debt equalization formula that was first enacted in 1993 was that we had a lot of districts that were able to do significant improvements to their facilities. And what happened was the first year the state paid 20%, the second year the state paid 15%, the third year the state paid 10%, and the fourth year the state wasn't paying anything. It was just an unstable system. If you're going to bond for 20 years and you're going to go to the voters and say, we'd like to build this building, the state's going to pay 25%, we're going to pay 75%, it would be nice if that mix stayed fairly uniform over time rather than having kind of the state share disappear after the first 3 years. And so that was why we settled on that 125% equalization level.
Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at that phase in, you know, and we still are equating everything on by a per pupil amount. I think about, for example, in greater Minnesota, where we have had facilities that, quite frankly, in my hometown, where I graduated in 74 as a class of 147, and now we have a hard time breaking 100, and in many communities, smaller communities, there's even a greater percentage change in terms of declining mm-hmm, enrollment. Mm-hmm. And yet they still have facilities that probably on a per pupil basis cost more to maintain mm-hmm. than the larger facilities. And does the plan that's in place adequately address those scenarios where they're actually encountering a greater per pupil cost because mm-hmm. of dealing with older, some cases outsized facilities as opposed to some of the more populous districts?
Excellent. Mr. Chairman and Senator Weber, I would say that the committee recommended moving up on a per pupil basis, and for all districts in the state that are not currently in the program, that would be an increase. But I think you're right. The per pupil basis, while it would be a little bit simpler, might not be as fair to the districts that have smaller schools where there's more square footage per student. And certainly if the legislature moves forward with this kind of a plan, you could look at the option of a per pupil basis as opposed to a per square footage basis. There's certainly a number of ways you could go. The idea was, though, that would not be a permanent solution, that the permanent solution would be to have the planning done at the local level to determine what the needs were. And so if you were in a school that had greater needs, the funding might be level, but you'd have to pay more because you would be looking at a, you know, 25% of a higher cost. So yes, certainly a per square footage basis would be an alternative to a per pupil basis, and I think that would be something the legislature might want to debate the merits of.
Thank you. I had a question for Dr. Melcher or any of the others that might want to weigh in. Each school district, I believe, looks at it as providing community education through our lifelong learning opportunities, the focus being K-12, more E-12 now as we strongly advocate, but lifelong learning. And there's many partnerships, as we know, with municipalities, county government, with post-secondary institutions. Is there a way for the facility, long-term facility reform plans, where we can further incentivize this cooperation to avoid separate silos, separate facilities, whether it be libraries or public works or others? This would not be a mandate, but perhaps it's a good thing to get greater efficiency and resources where they're serving a common group. I know there's mm-hmm. many examples of where this is being done, mm-hmm. but I've also seen where it probably should have been done, but because some turfs had to be protected, it didn't. And so the taxpayers lost out. So thoughts on further incentivizing mm-hmm. for the co-location of facilities as appropriate?
Well, Senator Wigger, I think that's an important concept for the committee and policymakers generally to look at and keep in mind. We know that if there are better vehicles for school districts to take care of these maintenance needs, that will be beneficial for community education activities. We know that schools are used not only during school hours, but for other purposes as well. I'm thinking we've got a number of school district people here that perhaps you could have participation here if in fact we have some folks that have had some experience there. It might be more meaningful than me.
No, I appreciate your comments as well, but if anyone else would like to weigh in on some of the untapped potential and how we look at this, because you know taxpayers fund all kinds of other facilities as well, and we read about a number of them, but at the local level, what might we do as it relates to this these recommendations for further co-location of facilities? It wouldn't be a mandate, but maybe a carrot. Would anyone like to offer thoughts? If not, that's fine. We may.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chair, we saw last year, Senator Tomasoni had a proposal to...
He did.
...try to bring, I don't think it was an actual consolidation, but it was to try to bring some better facilities for use by several districts, and I maybe we should ask him how that all turned out. But I think it wasn't. There's still an enormous amount of independence out there among our independent school districts, more so in some parts of the state than others.
There's this local control. We get that. So, but limited dollars. Senator Saxhog, and then I believe Senator Torres-Ray had a question. Senator
Saxhog. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, on the line of questioning of both the chairman and Senator Stumpf, is there something we can do to promote collaborations or consolidations? And ultimately, can these school districts then pool their resources that come out of here, and if they can come up with a better facility, it might be an incentive for some of the independents that Senator Stumpf talks about not to dissolve, but...
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxhog, one of the recommendations from the committee was that we have enhanced debt service equalization for school districts that had some unique circumstances. Last year, the legislature adopted part of that recommendation, which was to provide enhanced debt service equalization for districts that have had a natural disaster. And what we saw was that both Rushford Peterson and Moose Lake were able to move forward and pass a bond issue, and they're still going to be paying most of the cost of those facilities locally, but they got some enhanced debt aid, and they're going to take care of that. The committee also recommended that the enhanced debt service equalization would apply to school districts that are consolidating, that need to have a new facility in order to address the needs, and for school districts that had unusually high debt service tax rates. We've got a very challenging system, and Senator Stumpf well knows this in terms of our capital loan situation, where we need an act of the legislature in the bonding bill to pass a capital loan. But we have some school districts that have unusually high debt service, but it doesn't quite reach the level of requiring a capital loan. So the idea here was, if you had that situation, perhaps you could get some enhanced debt equalization, but you'd still be paying the majority of the cost on your own. The other thing I would say is that the legislature did, as part of the legislation last year, provide for the cooperative operation of a secondary facility. It originated with the Iron Range schools that you referred to, but that law actually is a statewide law. So if we did have other school districts that were interested in having a cooperative high school, we have the provision on the books that would allow for some cooperation aid to help with that. We don't currently have that funded on the facility side, but theoretically that could be a candidate for enhanced debt service equalization as well.
Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if Mr. Mulcher will be the person to respond, or maybe Ms. Harmonson, who is in the audience too. I'm curious about charter schools. An interesting kind of connects to this conversation we're having about opportunities to collaborate and build, you know, partnerships with these schools. But in general, I am curious about the department's effort to really look into facilities for charter schools. I have had some calls from individuals, parents, and advocates in the community who believe that some of the schools, the charter schools, are functioning in facilities that are not adequate for the children that are attending those schools. And I am curious to know whether or not you think this is part of the conversation in terms of resources and abilities that these schools have to have adequate spaces, and what is the criteria? I don't even know what is the criteria for established by the state to really define what adequate space actually is, for not just for charter schools. I think the question has come from individuals who have children in charter schools, but in general, does the state of Minnesota define what adequate space actually is, what an adequate facility is? Because in that context, I feel that legally we have to support the kind of the maintenance and the acquisition of adequate space for students.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I don't know that I'm totally prepared to answer your question. I do know we do a minimum review of charter space when an application comes in for lease aid. I think Mr. Piccolo outlined an area that we do need to do much more review of and discussion of. I would have to have our charter people. I used to have charter schools 2 years ago. I don't have as much oversight of charter schools right now. But I would like to have further discussions with you, because I think there are some concerns. And I think our being able to review the space is minimal at this point to make sure that they're adequate. It's going to depend on what age level those kids are as well. But I do share your concern, and I think I would like to have our charter people maybe respond more in full to this, because at this point I don't feel totally prepared to be able to answer that for you. But I do know we do a minimal review of lease applications when they come in to check on certain things, and I don't know if Mr. Melcher can add to what those areas are.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, the lease aid statute requires the department to review the applications to ensure that we look at the reasonableness of the price, but we also look at the appropriateness of the space. But we do a very minimal level of review. We verify that the school district that the building meets the fire code. We don't want to have a fire trap, obviously. We verify that it's zoned properly, but it's a very very low standard that we currently have. We're not looking at the educational adequacy. It's more, is the amount of square feet appropriate for the size of the school, and is it a structurally sound building that kind of meets code to make sure we don't have children in an unsafe situation? But it certainly doesn't do anything in terms of optimizing whether this is a good environment for learning.
Senator Torres-Ray, and then I believe Mr. Piccolo wanted to add a statement.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm very interested in this issue, as you hear, you know, the fact that we just really don't review this, basically. And more and more, I think we are having, you know, opportunities to really look at how we, open these opportunities for children. I know that we have a lot of children of color attending charter schools in my district. And so for me, the idea that we need to review carefully where these children are being are attending school, and what these facilities offer in terms of just adequate minimal physical space for a kid. I think this is a very important issue, and I would like to recommend that the department kind of looks into that. I'm hoping to have a hearing in our committee, however, you know, the session evolves, to really look at what are these spaces offering in a very just academic term, but also physical term, developmental you know, capacity. So, Mr. Piccolo, I don't know if you can offer some ideas as to how we can engage in a conversation of this nature, because I think that way we can also open the opportunity to have a conversation about the need for expanding resources for these
Mr. children. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I think two things. One is, because charter schools are funded through lease aid for their facilities, and charter schools are not, you know, grow gradually in terms of enrollment, what happens oftentimes is charter schools lease space for a short period of time, then move to another space or expand space. And because of the tie into enrollment the way it is, sometimes the space needs don't catch up until later on, until the school gets to a certain point in terms of enrollment and stability. And so sometimes some of our schools are probably in less than ideal situations in terms of where they're located. I think one of the other things is that, you know, our biggest landlord in terms of the most schools, charter schools, rent from the church, the Catholic Church, old, you know, Catholic school buildings. They are our single biggest landlord, and a lot of those buildings have not been updated for years and years and years and years. And so some of those facilities are not necessarily the most modern facilities. On the other hand, we do have schools, for example, in terms of City Academy, which is located in a city recreation center in a partnership with the city of St. Paul. And so that facility is kept up by the city, and so it's kept the lease cost of that school way down. I mean, it's like $4 a square foot because the city is working together. So that's one of the reasons why we're looking and have proposed, again, looking at which schools should be able to own buildings directly, because I think one of the things is when you are leasing the building, you don't have control over necessarily all aspects of that facility. In fact, many of our schools are in facilities that are used by other groups too. That may be, for example, we have a school in Northtown Shopping Center. They lease this part of that shopping center, but the whole shopping center is not under their control. So we have a lot of those kinds of situations where the facilities, again, because they don't own them, they don't have any control over what goes on in some of them, except for the basic health and safety. They have to get the fire rating and so forth. But beyond that, they really don't control the use of those facilities or the renovation of those facilities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I think we would welcome your ideas and suggestions if you want us to have more oversight. At this point, we do not have that. At the time we established this working group, it was at the initiative of the commissioner and the department that we did add a representative of charter schools. We think there are issues that probably do need to be addressed, and we would welcome your direction on how and what things we should be looking at. Dealt with some charters and indicated that we did not think that those facilities were appropriate, and they have gone and sought other facilities. But our ability to provide this direction and requirement are somewhat limited. So we would welcome that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the invitation, and I also would like to invite, I know we have experts in the audience about this particular issue, and I think that this will be an opportunity for us to review, you know, this very issue of what are the key elements of this lease aid, and how is that detrimental, you know, if you don't own the building. So how can we move in this direction? But also, you know, what is inadequate and what are the consequences for these children that are attending that happen to be predominantly very low-income children. And I think we really have the, you know, we are responsible for really figuring out a better option. And it might, you know, it might be complicated at the beginning, but over the long period of time, it will be to the advantage of the charter schools themselves, but just to the kids that are attending those schools.
And Mr. Chair and Senators, there's going to be a variety of issues that are going to come into this. For example, one specific instance that I recall happened very recently is we were made aware of a school that was just starting up and had gotten themselves into a 30-year lease. Well, that creates long-term issues if we don't know the viability of the charter. So I think you're going to find that there will be other issues as we have this discussion that we probably need to bring into the mix as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Johnson had a question for Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Piccolo, I was intrigued by your local government conduit financing and not familiar with that. And I'm wondering if that is some sort of a model that could be used in a way to get public schools to cooperate with each other in terms of their facilities. I'm wondering how you were able to entice them into helping you with the financing.
Ms. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think the way that has operated is as these affiliate billing companies have gone out, and the bond houses have gone to local governments because there is that conduit bond that a lot of nonprofits use, and charter school affiliate billing companies are nonprofits. And so the cities are or townships or whatever are issuing those bonds. I think part of it is there's a, you know, the revenue bonds are pay for themselves, so there's no big risk to the city unless there's a major default. And there's a benefit to the city or the township for that. I think part of it is, in some cases, it's seen as an economic development issue. For example, in St. Paul, I think you look at one school, Nova Classical Academy, for example, they located their new facility in an area that was basically a brownfield that was cleaned up, and the city built a new neighborhood there and built some commercial areas, and so there's a school now as part of that. So it was seen as a part of redevelopment of the that part of the city. And so I think each city does it for a particular reason. In other places, it's because there hasn't been a school in the community or they wanted more school choices, and so the local community has issued the bonds, the conduit revenue bonds for that facility.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like
Senator
to
Johnson.
Say it pleases me to even think about this sort of thing because, as I recall, the mission of charter schools was to provide innovative education policy that could be replicated. And that's what I'm asking about. Is there something there that could be replicated in terms of the situation that we discussed earlier with Senator Tomasoni's schools, to some way or another make it happen that people know that it's really for the benefit of the whole community, whether it be schools or whether it be cities or other entities.
Senator Wieger, Senator Johnson, I think a great example of that is down in Ridgeway, Minnesota, just west of Winona. There, the charter school is a little town, you know, north of Houston and so forth. What they did was when they added on to the facility, the township used to have a library. And so the space now that was built onto the school is both a school library during the day and the community library at night. And it's open to the public in the evenings and some days of the weekend as a public library. And during the daytime, it's the school's library. We also have Milroy, Minnesota, for example, where the school district, over the years, it's a very small district, tuitioned out its high school kids to other communities because they could not sustain a high school. They chartered the elementary grades, and the middle school grades are still part of the traditional school district.
and they are co-located in the same building. They actually share the facility. They also share some personnel as a way of cooperating. So we do have some models like that that have led to cooperation between districts and the broader community as well as the traditional district.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe more of a request. If we could get this presentation in a soft copy that we could share with our districts. I know, as I mentioned, equalization is a hot topic down where I live, and I'd like to at least have something to facilitate the conversation with my superintendents. And then I think you mentioned you had some runs. If we could see some of what those runs might look like by district, that would sure be helpful.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt, Ms. Anderson has a copy of the PowerPoint, so I'm sure you could share that, get that from Senate staff.
Okay.
As far as the runs, we do have runs that are published on the Department of Education website as part of the original report, but those are pretty dated. So what we're hoping to do is some updated runs after the November forecast is released that would be available December, January timeframe.
Terrific. That at least helps. From a timing standpoint. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. On behalf of the joint committees, we thank each of the testifiers for your excellent testimony. I assure you there will be a great deal of follow-up as we prepare soon for the upcoming session. Announcements, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm looking forward to our next hearing, and from there on we're going to have multiple hearings when we come back. So I encourage members to really bring your issues to our attention so that we can begin to formulate a schedule for some of the issues that you are interested in bringing to our attention. So I'm looking for that. You will receive a message from our staff inviting you to please contact us as soon as you possibly can to bring your the issues, you know, issues that are happening in your district, proposals that you want to bring to our attention. So I look forward to hear from you and the public as well, of course.
Sarah Clausen, I know that you've been doing visits on college and the schools. I think you're out with Senator Pratt and his district, and I know you've got more planned. Would you like to just give us a quick update on college and the schools?
Sure. We have been visiting various schools around the area about the college and the schools program. I think we're all concerned about the cost of higher education, but also providing some just outstanding opportunities for students that are college ready in our high school, and kind of blending the E-12 program into an E-14 program. And yesterday we were out at Buffalo and Watertown Mare High Schools visiting. We have some additional scheduled meetings here in the metro area. In addition to that, people through the University of Minnesota have been going outstate. They've been down in the Rochester area. And we also have a meeting set up with the Minsky schools to talk about their college and the schools program, so looking beyond just the University of Minnesota system. So one of the big issues that we have at currently, it's a growing program. It keeps students in their local schools, and it's very much underfunded right now. The funding has been static, and the growth of the program has just been increasing. So that'll be something we'll be addressing, hopefully, in the upcoming session. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. I know each of you are involved in interfacing with your own local districts. That's great. And I had extended invitation. If you wanted me or others to come to your district or had an idea to share, let me know. I just had distributed a couple of visits I have upcoming. And, again, I responded affirmatively to anyone that did that wanted me to come, and I didn't take it personally if you didn't want me either. But coming up will be in Minnetonka looking at the Chinese immersion program on Tuesday the 18th. On the 19th at Centennial Public Schools at some sites, and then on the 25th we'll be at Laverne Public Schools. I sure hope it's not snowing that morning.
I was going to say, Senator Weaver, are you going to be there at 7:30 a.m.?
Then we've been leaving at 2 a.m., but no, we'll be there on time, I hope so.
Great. So we have those planned, and if any member would like to join us, usually we extend an invite to the House member and the respective district, let us know. And we carpool, obviously, whenever we can. Our next joint hearing and final one for the year will be on December 8th, and that will focus on early education. You know, we've put a lot of additional effort in that area. We have several people that have expressed an interest in testifying, and that'll be the focus for the next hearing. There being no further business, the joint committee is adjourned.